If you'd like to open your Bibles to the Gospel of Mark, we will be picking up our study in that book in just a moment. Or you can look at the screen. All the verses should be there, as usual. I thought I'd share with you that I just appreciate the opportunity to be able to talk about God's Word. I love God's Word. I'm so excited when I discover things that I think will be exciting for other people to discover too. And oftentimes after I preach, I just replay the sermon in my head over and over, and I think about how it went and whether I felt like I accomplished my purpose or said the things I wanted to say in the way I meant to say them. And sometimes I just feel like I just really dumped a lot on everybody. So that's why you had a handout this morning, I guess. But I try to preach different styles, different ways, different topics. Everybody needs different kinds of things. And so I appreciate you being patient with me sometimes if maybe it's not the particular lesson that meant the most to you. But that being said, I do appreciate the compliments and the encouragement that I received after this morning. I don't think it was a flop or a total failure, but I just want to say I appreciate your patience with me, and I know that sometimes I feel better about some lessons than others. All of that being said, we are in Mark chapter 6, and we are finishing Mark chapter 6 and getting into Mark chapter 7. And we've been seeing the things that Jesus has been doing and saying, and that's the way that Mark has been introducing Jesus to us. And what I've suggested is that what these stories have been showing us is that for us to be all that we can be, we have to appreciate all that Jesus is. The fact is, Jesus is the Son of God, and Jesus is the perfect representation of God's character and God's image. And so if we are going to be children of God, and if we are going to be what we were made to be, which is in the image of God, representations of his character, the only way that we can do that is by following him. He is our example, and he is the representation of what we ought to be. And all of that was especially evident in the last story that we covered in chapter 6, which was the feeding of the 5,000. You know, it was very clear that the disciples of Jesus were not sufficient in themselves, but they found sufficiency in him. When they realized that all they had was 5 loaves and 2 fish, they realized that wasn't enough, but in the hands of Jesus, it was more than enough. There were actually leftovers that were gathered up. And I wanted to point out one other thing. I mentioned that Mark was the only gospel writer who recorded that the grass was green, and I liked that detail in the feeding of the 5,000. And after that sermon, Rob Dysart talked to me about that, and he said, you know what it made me think of was the 23rd Psalm. And I thought more about that, and I thought, man, that makes a lot of sense. I'm going to use that next time. You know, in Psalm 23, it talks about how the Lord is my shepherd. He leads me beside still waters, makes me lie down in green pastures. Maybe Mark is wanting us to see that the Lord, Jesus, is the good shepherd. He's a manifestation of the good shepherd from Psalm 23. So go ahead and add that to last week's lesson. Okay. With all of that being said, we make it now to verse 45. We'll read verses 45 through 52. Immediately, he made his disciples get into the boat and go before him to the other side, to Bethsaida, while he dismissed the crowd. And after he had taken leave of them, he went up on the mountain to pray. And when evening came, the boat was out on the sea, and he was alone on the land. And he saw that they were making headway painfully, for the wind was against them. And about the fourth watch of the night, he came to them, walking on the sea. He meant to pass by them, but when they saw him walking on the sea, they thought it was a ghost and cried out, for they all saw him and were terrified. But immediately he spoke to them and said, "Take heart, it is I, do not be afraid." And he got into the boat with them, and the wind ceased. And they were utterly astounded, for they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. So Jesus now sends his disciples by boat to Bethsaida, and he takes time to pray. You know, this has been a really long day for Jesus. If you remember last week and you go back to the story, Jesus had started the day with a boat ride from the east side of the Sea of Galilee. Now he's made it to the west side. And when they get off the boat, remember, they were looking for a desolate place to rest, and there was a great crowd there, and Jesus had compassion on them. And he began to teach them, and he fed them, and eventually he sends them on their way. And now he takes a second boat ride up to Bethsaida, and, or actually his disciples do, but Jesus takes the time to pray. Prayer was very important to Jesus. He made time for it. Even when he was busy with other things, even when he had other things going on, even when he was tired. There are actually three times in the book of Mark that we're told explicitly that Jesus took time to pray. The first time was in chapter 1, right at the beginning of his ministry. The third time is in Gethsemane, at the end of his ministry, in chapter 14. And this is the second time, which is really at the height of his popularity. And I think all three of those times would have been very challenging for Jesus for very different reasons. At the beginning of his ministry, right before his crucifixion, and here at the height of his popularity. And Jesus knew that he needed to spend time with his Father in prayer. But so the story is given to us that the disciples were out on the sea, and Jesus is on land. He's on the mountain praying. And it gets to be between 3 and 6 a.m., and it's stormy. So imagine these disciples being out in the sea, in the boat, and it's storming, and here comes Jesus walking to them on the water. I think for a lot of my life, I hadn't really thought about this picture the way that I should. I always imagined like a very calm and serene kind of thing, Jesus gliding on a smooth surface. That's not the way this would have looked. I mean, there would have been waves crashing, there would have been clouds, there would have been thunder and lightning, and in the midst of all of that foam and spray, here comes the silhouette walking on the water. It's no surprise then that the disciples say, "This is a ghost." I mean, that would be sort of terrifying, very unexpected. And so in the storm, Jesus is walking on the water and he comes to the disciples and they think that he is a ghost. And it reminds us of the first time that Jesus calmed a storm. This is the second time that Jesus has calmed a storm in the book of Mark. The first time was in chapter 4. And the first time, Jesus was already in the boat with them. Remember, he was asleep on a cushion. And then when he gets into the boat, he speaks and he calms the storm. This time, he speaks to calm the disciples. And then he gets into the boat and the storm is calmed. You know, I'm not exactly sure what verse 52 means. When it mentions that they did not understand about the loaves, but their hearts were hardened. But there was a lesson that Jesus wanted them to learn from the loaves. There was something that he wanted them to remember from feeding the 5,000. And because they didn't remember that and they didn't understand it, their hearts were hardened. Maybe the lesson is this, that Jesus wants his disciples to know that he is always with them. That whether he is in the boat or whether he's away on a mountain, that his presence is with them, his power is with them, and they need never be afraid. And that, as we have talked about with the feeding of the 5,000, Jesus wanted them to see that they did not have sufficiency in themselves, but they could have sufficiency in him. That they had his power in them and through them. That if they were willing to give themselves to Jesus, that Jesus could use them for great and amazing things. And so maybe the point that Jesus wants his disciples to remember, and the point that we would do well to remember today, is that Jesus will never leave us or forsake us. Whether he is walking among us in his sandals, or whether he is seated at the right hand of the throne of God, his presence is with us, and we need never be afraid. Well, as we continue with the story in verse 53, they make it to where they're going in the boat. It says in verse 53, when they had crossed over, they came to land at Gennesaret and moored to the shore. And when they got out of the boat, the people immediately recognized him and ran about the whole region and began to bring the sick people on their beds to wherever they heard he was. And wherever he came, in villages, cities, or countryside, they laid the sick in the marketplaces and implored him that they might touch even the fringe of his garment. And as many as touched it were made well. So now they end up back on the west side of the Sea of Galilee, a little bit south of Capernaum. And everybody and their mothers is running to Jesus and bringing their sick to him, like literally. everybody and all of their family, they're running to and fro, they're gathering the sick, and they're desperately coming to where Jesus is so that he can heal them. What's interesting is the word in verse 56 that is translated made well. That word is literally saved. It's at the end of verse 56, as many as touched it were saved. People were saved from their physical ailments. They were saved from the physical handicaps that were enslaving them. You know, if you knew that Jesus could save your friends and your family from the illnesses and the sicknesses that enslaved them, you would probably make every effort to bring them to Jesus too. I think about different people in my life who have suffered from terrible illnesses, different times where I was desperate to try to help them find healing, eager to find somebody that could free them of the illness that they were suffering with. But see, the point for us is that as eager as we would be to bring people to Jesus who we love so that he can save them from their physical illnesses, are we as eager to bring people to Jesus to be saved of their spiritual illnesses? You see, what we're seeing here is a physical representation of the salvation that Jesus can provide and the logical reaction to realizing it. If Jesus can heal and Jesus can free people of their diseases, then this is exactly what you would do with Jesus. Are we as eager to bring people to him as these people are? That's one lesson that we can take from this. But now, as we move on to chapter 7, the Pharisees come back into the picture. In Mark chapter 7, beginning in verse 1, it says, "Now when the Pharisees gathered to him with some of the scribes who had come from Jerusalem, they saw that some of his disciples ate with hands that were defiled, that is, unwashed. For the Pharisees and all the Jews do not eat unless they wash their hands properly, holding to the tradition of the elders. And when they come from the marketplace, they do not eat unless they wash. And there are many other traditions that they observe, such as the washing of cups and pots and copper vessels and dining couches. And the Pharisees and the scribes asked him, 'Why do your disciples not walk according to the tradition of the elders, but eat with unwashed hands?'" So the next issue that the scribes and the Pharisees bring to Jesus is that they notice that his disciples are eating without washing their hands. This is one of those stories that, you know, you don't really know whether to laugh or cry. It's like, man, that's the worst thing you can find for Jesus and his disciples. And it's important to realize that they're not so concerned with hygiene. This isn't like your mama getting onto you because you went to the table without washing your hands. But they are concerned with their Jewish religious traditions. And the reason why is because God had given, in fact, many cleanliness laws in the law of Moses. But what had happened was that the tradition of the elders had gone beyond the laws that God had written in Leviticus and Deuteronomy and Numbers and so forth. And the idea was that, you know, if you're out and you're in the marketplace and you're brushing shoulders with some people, I mean, maybe you touch a Gentile, maybe you touch something unclean. So what you really ought to do is, just to be safe, just to be careful, do a ritual cleansing to make sure that you're not unclean. Now again, this was something that went beyond the law. This wasn't something that God had explicitly said, but you can understand why people would develop a tradition like this. But what's fascinating is that Jesus just totally disregards it, you know? Before we ever get the idea that Jesus was just a total religious conservative who never ever offended people or stepped on their toes, that's not Jesus. Jesus ruffled feathers sometimes. Jesus disregarded human traditions if he felt like that they were being treated in a way that was inappropriate. Jesus never broke God's laws, but Jesus had no qualms about breaking human traditions. But as we continue in the text, Jesus begins to teach about this. In verse 6, he said to them, "Well did Isaiah prophesy of you hypocrites. As it is written, 'This people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. In vain do they worship me, teaching as doctrines the commandments of men.' You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men." And he said to them, you have a fine way of rejecting the commandment of God in order to establish your tradition. For Moses said, honor your father and your mother, and whoever reviles father or mother must surely die. But you say, if a man tells his father or his mother, whatever you would have gained from me is Corban, that is, given to God, then you no longer permit him to do anything for his father or mother, thus making void the word of God by your tradition that you have handed down. And many such things you do. You know, everybody has traditions. And traditions are not necessarily bad things. In fact, I would submit that it's impossible not to have traditions. If you do the same thing in the same way more than one time, that's a tradition. But the problem comes when our traditions become more important to us than what God's commands are. And I think that Jesus identifies at least three different layers to the problem here. And this is really important, I think, for us to pay attention to. There are three layers to the problem of their traditions. For one, their religion had become more external than internal. Do you see that in verse 6? He says, this people honors me with their lips, but their heart is far from me. That's why he calls them hypocrites. You know, they're more concerned with what's going on the outside, but their hearts are being neglected. There's not a sincere love for God. There's not a reverence for God. There's not an appreciation for God's ways, but really they're just concerned with what's happening that other people can see. A second layer is they're binding their traditions as if they were God's commands. You see in verse 7, it says they're teaching as doctrines the commandments of men. What they've done is they've taken their human traditions and they've practiced them for so long and they've seen the value in them perhaps for a while that now they start to talk about, like, this is really what everybody should do without exception. And if somebody was to break their traditions, they would begin to frown upon them as if they had broken a law of God, when in fact, that wasn't the case. But a third thing that happens with these human traditions is that they're actually neglecting God's commands for the sake of their traditions. You see that in verse 8? You leave the commandment of God and hold to the tradition of men. So, number one, their religion has become more external than internal. Number two, they're binding their traditions as if they were God's commands. And number three, they're neglecting God's commands for the sake of their traditions. And Jesus actually gives them another example in verse 9 through 13. You know, they didn't really bargain for all of this when they criticized them for not washing their hands. But Jesus says, I'll do you one better. Here's another thing that you do that's totally bogus. You guys have this weird tradition where if there is a child who decides that he can dedicate whatever gain he has to God, then he's no longer bound to take care of his parents. And Jesus says, I mean, that doesn't even make sense. That's not the spirit of the law, and you know it. But because they are more bound by the traditions that they have instead of what God has said, they've departed from the very spirit of God's laws themselves. And don't miss that in verse 13, he also adds, and many such things you do. You know, if you want to look at the list of the many such things, you can go to Matthew chapter, I don't have in my notes, but where Jesus condemns the Pharisees for all of the hypocrisy that they do. He goes on and gives them many different lists, a list of many different things. But again, it seems like they got a lot more than they bargained for when they criticized his disciples for not washing their hands. Now, it would be good for us to meditate on these principles. Because we read this and we might think, like, man, how could those Pharisees be so blind? How could they be so silly to come to these conclusions? But the fact is, it's a lot easier for us to see the blind spots in other people than in ourselves. And the fact is that we have religious traditions too. You know, I mentioned earlier, traditions are not inherently bad. And really, traditions are unavoidable. We just get into a habit of doing certain things in certain ways. But you can probably think of some of those examples. So, how do we know? How do we know whether something is a human tradition or whether it's a command from God? And to keep things very simple, the answer is whether or not we see it written in God's word. If we can see that God has commanded us to do something, that's from God. But if it's not written in God's word, that's a tradition that we've created, maybe for good reasons. But some examples that I've thought of is how we dress for worship. You know, in this country for a long time, there's been a tradition of putting on your Sunday best. For good reason, people have wanted to show reverence to God. People might be motivated by the right things, but what we need to understand is that is a tradition. There's nothing in the Bible that says that you must wear a tie or else I'm in bad shape, right? Another tradition that we often have is putting the name Church of Christ on the sign. Think about this with me. Church of Christ is a description of a local church that follows Christ, that belongs to Christ. There are other names that we could use. Sometimes churches in the New Testament are referred to assemblies of God, churches of God, simply the church at a certain place. And so, do we have a good reason for following a tradition of using the word, the phrase Church of Christ? Maybe so. But that is a tradition that we have. As long as we stay within what the scriptures give us as examples of descriptions of God's people. Maybe another example would be ending every lesson with an invitation. I'll confess, when I get to the end of a lesson, it just sort of spills out. Come now while we stand and sing. Don't yet, you know. But that is a tradition that we have. And what I want to say about traditions like that is that those are all fine. And maybe they're helpful. Maybe it's good that we do those things traditionally. But we have to recognize that those are traditions. And it's fine as long as we're careful that we remember the principles that Jesus is teaching here. If we begin to focus more on the externals than the internals, we're making the same mistake as the Pharisees. If we're offended when other people break the traditions that we have, we're making the same mistake as the Pharisees. And if our traditions actually cause us to neglect God's commands in some way, then we're making the same mistake as the Pharisees. And so this would be a good warning for us, is that as we think about what we do and why we do it, that we make sure that we have an understanding of what is human tradition and what is actually a command from God. Now, Jesus goes on to teach more on this in verse 14. It says, he called the people to him again and said to them, hear me, all of you, and understand, there is nothing outside a person that by going into him can defile him. But the things that come out of a person are what defile him. And when he had entered the house and left the people, his disciples asked him about the parable. And he said to them, then are you also without understanding? Do you not see that whatever goes into a person from outside cannot defile him, since it enters not his heart but his stomach and is expelled? Thus he declared all foods clean. And he said, what comes out of a person is what defiles him. For from within, out of the heart of man, come evil thoughts, sexual immorality, theft, murder, adultery, coveting, wickedness, deceit, sensuality, envy, slander, pride, foolishness. All these evil things come from within, and they defile a person. So now Jesus goes on to teach an even deeper lesson. And again, I think it's much more than they ever bargained for when they criticized them for not washing hands. But Jesus' point is that God is concerned with a person's heart. You know, the issue at hand is about what makes a person unclean. And what Jesus wants them to understand is that the Jewish person who ate unclean food wasn't unclean because of the food that he ate. It wasn't the food that went into him, but it was his heart that led him to disobey God. That's the issue. That's the problem. The decision comes from a person's heart. We should be a lot more concerned about what's coming out of us than what's going into us. Charles Spurgeon once said, sin is not a splash of mud upon man's exterior. It is a filth generated within himself. I think that's a good thing for us to think about. Is that sometimes that when we sin, it's like, oh no, like I've kind of like muddied the outside of me. And we underestimate just how deep that problem comes from. And really, that's what the gospel is about. That as we are saved and as we are filled with the Spirit and as we are conformed to the image of God, God is not so much concerned with simple behavior modification. He's not concerned with us simply making external changes. The external changes ought to come when his word has an impact on our hearts. Jesus would talk about that it's, you have to make the tree good if you want to make the fruit good. The gospel is calling us to have total heart transformation. Notice in verse 21 that the list that Jesus gives is a list that starts with evil thoughts. And from there, it describes six different actions and six different attitudes. Your thoughts are powerful. The things that you let your mind meditate on and focus on are going to be the things that define what you think about and the things that you do. Proverbs chapter 4 and verse 23 says, "Keep your heart with all vigilance, for from it flow the springs of life." Also look with me in Philippians chapter 4. This is a commonly referred to text, and I think for good reason. Philippians chapter 4 and in verse 8. "Finally, brothers, whatever is true, whatever is honorable, whatever is just, whatever is pure, whatever is lovely, whatever is commendable, if there is any excellence, if there is anything worthy of praise, think about these things." You know, when we cultivate righteous thoughts, those righteous thoughts will produce righteous actions and righteous attitudes. Here's just a practical tip for what it's worth. What are the last things that you think about when you fall asleep at night? I think that reveals a lot about where our hearts are. What are the things that your mind naturally gravitates to? What are the things that you meditate on? Jesus says that the things that come out of us are evidence of what's going on deep within us, and we need to take that seriously. But now, in verse 24, Jesus moves on to the region of Tyre. "And from there he arose and went away to the region of Tyre and Sidon. And he entered a house and did not want anyone to know, yet he could not be hidden. But immediately a woman whose little daughter had an unclean spirit heard of him and came and fell down at his feet. Now the woman was a Gentile, a Syrophoenician by birth. And she begged him to cast the demon out of her daughter. And he said to her, 'Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs.' But she answered him, 'Yes, Lord. Yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs.' And he said to her, 'For this statement, you may go your way. The demon has left your daughter.' And she went home and found the child lying in bed and the demon gone." So Jesus goes on to the region of Tyre, which is actually the region of Phoenicia. Tyre and Sidon were major cities in that region, and so sometimes it's referred to the region of Tyre and Sidon. But this is Gentile country. Jesus has now traveled about 40 miles northwest of Capernaum. And according to Jewish religious tradition, traveling here would have made Jesus unclean. And we've already well established that Jesus doesn't really pay much mind to Jewish religious tradition. He goes there. But we also notice that Jesus goes there to be alone with his disciples. And again, it doesn't really work out that way. Just like when he ended up feeding the 5,000, there are people that sort of just throng him wherever he goes. But this time, Jesus is approached by a woman whose daughter has an unclean spirit. And this woman is a Gentile. The text tells us that she is Syrophoenician, which is sort of a mashup of the words Syrian and Phoenician. So she has Gentile heritage from Syrian and Phoenician heritage. And Jesus' response in verse 27 is really interesting. So this woman comes to Jesus saying, "You know, I've got this daughter with an unclean spirit." And in verse 27, Jesus says, "Let the children be fed first, for it is not right to take the children's bread and throw it to the dogs." Okay, stop there for a second. First of all, every time I read this verse, I think about how I want to frame it and put it in my kitchen. Because we have a little dog that the children love to feed. And over again, we have to tell them, "No, that is not for Squid. That's for you." The dog's name's Squid. That's a side point. But, you know, don't feed squid. You eat your food. It's not right to take the children's food and throw it to the dogs. And I'll tell you what, it's so frustrating sometimes. You know, it's like when you have worked hard on something and you've made some food and you're trying to, like, give your kids a good, nutritious meal, and then you, like, out of the corner of your eye, you see them just fling it to the dog and she gobbles it up. It's frustrating. All right, I got to get off the soapbox, but, you know, like. But see, I think that's Jesus' point, is that it's not appropriate to take what belongs to the children and throw it to the dogs. That's a waste. Okay, now that we understand that, it becomes very challenging for us. Because what Jesus is saying seems harsh, maybe even racist. That if he's referring to Gentiles as dogs, like, okay, what's going on, Jesus? Why are you speaking like this to this woman? Well, I think it's important for us to understand that God intended for Jesus to focus his ministry on the Jews, not the Gentiles. In Matthew chapter 15 and verse 24, in the parallel text, Matthew adds that Jesus says, "I was sent only to the lost sheep of the house of Israel." You see, in the greater context, what God's plan for Jesus is that he knew that Israel would reject Jesus. He knew that the nation would end up having him put to death. But he always planned to extend salvation to everyone after Israel had made that choice. Israel's got to have the opportunity to reject the Messiah. But here's what I think Jesus is doing in this instance. Jesus wants his disciples to see the humility and the faith of this Gentile woman. And he's giving her an opportunity to manifest that. He's making the point that it's not your physical heritage that makes you clean. It's not that you have a bloodline that can be traced back to Abraham. The true Israel will be the people who share the faith of Abraham, like Paul will write about extensively in Galatians and in Romans. And if Jesus' words were shocking to this woman in verse 27, her response is even more shocking. It's also very witty. "Yes, Lord. Yet even the dogs under the table eat the children's crumbs." I think it was last week I shared a quote from a friend of mine. I'll tell you his name. His name's Tom Hawley. He preaches in Starkville, Mississippi. He's the one that likes to say, "Don't let your familiarity with a text rob you of its wonder." Another thing that I hear him say sometimes is, "You can't humiliate a humble man." And that's what stands out to me about this woman. She's humble enough that she won't be humiliated. She desires the good things, the blessings from Jesus enough that she's not going to be easily dissuaded. Instead of being offended, she's eager to accept whatever the Lord will give her. And she's persistent. She's persistent enough that she will not miss out on the Lord's blessing. So if any of my kids are listening, don't throw your quesadilla to the dog. But if some crumbs fall off the table, then yeah, that's fine. And that's exactly the point that this woman makes to Jesus. Is what harm is it if some crumbs fall off the table and I benefit? But what we see is her faith and her humility. And when we have humility and faith like this woman, we'll find that the Lord blesses us too. Blessed is the one who's not offended by Jesus. But now, the last text in this chapter, verses 31 through 37. "Then he returned from the region of Tyre and went through Sidon to the Sea of Galilee, in the region of the Decapolis. And they brought to him a man who was deaf and had a speech impediment, and they begged him to lay his hand on him. And taking him aside from the crowd privately, he put his fingers into his ears, and after spitting, touched his tongue. And looking up to heaven, he sighed and said to him, 'Ephphatha,' that is, be opened. And his ears were opened, his tongue was released, and he spoke plainly. And Jesus charged them to tell no one. But the more he charged them, the more zealously they proclaimed it. And they were astonished beyond measure, saying, 'He has done all things well. He even makes the deaf hear and the mute speak.'" Now Jesus heads back to the east side of the Sea of Galilee, deep into Gentile territory. And this is a miracle that is only recorded by Mark of the four gospel accounts that we have, and it's a strange one. And so the immediate question that we have is, why does Jesus do what he does in verses 33 and 34? I don't know if you've, I'm sure you have, but everybody's done this at some point. You've stuck your fingers in your ears and touched your tongue, and like earwax is not a pleasant taste. I don't know why Jesus was doing that exactly. But it says that Jesus put his fingers in his ears, spits, presumably, you know, to the side, and then touches his tongue. That seems like a lot when we know that Jesus need only speak to heal the man. But think about from this man's perspective. He has problems hearing, and he has problems speaking. You know, if Jesus was just standing in front of him, he might not have understood what Jesus was saying, and the next thing he knew, suddenly his ears were opened and he was speaking. But I think that Jesus does this for this man's benefit. He's pointing out to him in a way that he can relate to, that I'm going to do something to your ears and I'm going to do something to your tongue. I'm going to heal them. He wants him and everybody there to know that this healing is from God through Jesus. Another detail that stands out to me in this, though, is in verse 34, it says that he sighed. That's a word that conveys a deep kind of expression. He groans. Jesus is genuinely moved with authentic compassion for this man's physical defects. He sees the handicap that this man has, and he feels sorry. Now, again, if we were to relate these things to spiritual things, if Jesus is compassionate for this man's physical defects, how much more compassionate is he for our spiritual defects? How much more does it grieve him when we experience spiritual deafness or spiritual muteness? And as always, we see that the healing is immediate. He does the miracle, and immediately his ears are opened, and his tongue is loosed, and he speaks plainly in verse 35. There's another command to keep silent in verse 36 that goes unheeded, but I think that the point at this point in Jesus' ministry, it's just sort of like the amazement of Jesus can't be contained. You know, everybody is just buzzing about who Jesus is and what he's doing, and people are just sort of whispering to each other in verse 37, he's done everything well. I mean, what does he do that's not perfect? What does he do that's not great? He's even making the deaf hear and the mute speak. Now, the word that Mark uses for this man's speech impediment is used only one time in the entire New Testament. It's right here. It's a very unique word, and it's only used in this text. But the only other time that it's used in the entire Bible is in the Old Testament. If we were to look at the Greek translation of the Old Testament, the Septuagint. And this is the last passage that we'll turn to, but if you look over in Isaiah chapter 35. In Isaiah 35, it's actually in verse 6 where this word is used that's translated to as a speech impediment here. But we're going to read verses 3 through 10. Isaiah 35 and verse 3. Strengthen the weak hands and make firm the feeble knees. Say to those who have an anxious heart, be strong, fear not. Behold, your God will come with vengeance, and the recompense of God. He will come and save you. Then the eyes of the blind shall be opened, and the ears of the deaf unstopped. Then shall the lame man leap like a deer, and the tongue of the mute sing for joy. For waters break forth in the wilderness, and streams in the desert. The burning sand shall become a pool, and the thirsty ground springs of water. In the haunt of jackals where they lie down, the grass shall become reeds and rushes, and a highway shall be there. And it shall be called the way of holiness. The unclean shall not pass over it. It shall belong to those who walk on the way. Even if they are fools, they shall not go astray. No lion shall be there, nor shall any ravenous beast come upon it. They shall not be found there, but the redeemed shall walk there. And the ransomed of the Lord shall return and come to Zion with singing. Everlasting joy shall be upon their heads. They shall obtain gladness and joy, and sorrow and sighing shall flee away. Again, this is the only other text in the entire Bible where that word is used. And I think that it's almost certain that Mark wants us to make this connection. that Jesus is the one who fulfills the blessings of the long-awaited Messiah. He is the Lord. He is God. Because he is who he is, you can be strong and fear not. He can cure you of your ailments. He can heal you of your diseases. He can redeem you and restore you. And because of him, you can walk on the way of holiness. That's who Jesus is. And that's who Jesus has made himself known to be. And you can have these blessings for yourself if you're willing to come to him too. We're going to sing an invitation song. As is our tradition, we're going to sing the song. It's a good tradition. It's a good opportunity. If there's somebody here that wants to make your life right with God, you can come to the front and let us know how we can help you while we stand together and sing.